Yeah. You can, hey, by the way, you can probably kill these lights up here if you'd like, just to get more on the screen. Well, good evening. It's great to be here again. I can guarantee you this, guaranteed, that there is not another church in the United States discussing this subject tonight. So you are definitely a unique congregation tonight to discuss this subject. What this is, it's a presentation I've put together about a hobby that I started when I was five. Okay, it's 49 years ago, and it dealt with carnivorous plants, and I'll tell you a little bit about how I got into this hobby. I was raised in a family that watched a lot of science fiction. When we're not a Christian family, and there were always different movies about plants trying to eat people, and I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. There was even a television show called The Addams Family, and you might recall that Morticia had a plant that she fed. Does anybody remember what the name of that plant was? Right? Cleopatra. I even have a small clip to show you from that show if you've never seen this before. I saw that and I thought that was the coolest thing I could ever imagine. But get this, when I was a youngster, my dad collected tropical fish. I grew up in North New Jersey. North New Jersey has a lot of tropical fish stores and pet stores back in the early 1960s. Back then, they sold pets that you can't sell anymore. If it bit you, could sting you and poison you, it was legal to sell. It's been changed. But in the springtime, they would sell a kit for growing a Venus flytrap. And it looked like a little fudge tin with a plastic dome. I see some of the heads going on that. And the idea was it had a picture of this cool-looking plant on the cover. You would take the lid off, and there was a bag of soil inside with a bulb in it, and you would pour the soil into the tin, plant the bulb, put the lid on with some water, and you were supposed to get this really cool-looking plant that ate things. Now, from the time that I was five to the time that I was 10, I must have tried, I can't even tell you, 15, 20 times to grow those plants. I'd get a green sprout, and it would promptly die. Now, my dad and mom were very generous, so every time they saw one, they would buy me one, and I would never, ever be able to grow it. Well, 1970 was a banner year for me. 1970, a now-extinct store called Kmart began to sell full-grown potted Venus flytraps. You didn't have to grow them from a kit. There was, and I mean, these pots were stuffed with them. I'll never forget the first time I saw them in this Kmart in New Jersey. My eyes popped out of my head like Bugs Bunny. I mean, it was loaded with Venus flytraps, and they were $1.99 per pot, which I remember very distinctly because I made $2 a week allowance in 1970. So every Friday, I ran back to that store for that month, and I brought them home. And I mean, I probably killed every one of them, but I had a ball with them. Well, it wasn't until a little bit while afterward, I was in the sixth grade, I had to do a science project. And as I was looking for an idea, I found the May 1961 edition of National Geographic, and it had an article on plants that eat insects. Well, I opened up the magazine, and it had that picture in it, and that was it. Heart was revived, and I began studying the plants, and I built a 4-foot-tall Venus flytrap that got me an A on the science project, which then inspired my mom to spend more money on my hobby, and I began growing them more and more, and I learned about how to grow them and how not to kill them. And one of the things I found very, very interesting was that carnivorous plants are not tropical plants by and large. I always assumed they grew in Africa in some dark, steamy jungle, and I discovered that the United States has about 50 species. In fact, we've got them in New Jersey. You have them right here in Michigan, growing right around this church. You've got different varieties of carnivorous plants. And as of today, there's close to 700 species that have been identified. It's a worldwide phenomenon. The only place you don't find them is in the Antarctic. And why do you think that is? Until you can get a plant that eats popsicles, there's nothing there for them to consume. And over the years, as my hobby has grown, I've had the chance to write some articles. I've been on television once. I've written quite a few articles. But I was able to present this to the Creation Museum in 2006. They were looking for programs. And the program I've designed, it's called Cursed Plants, and that's what you're going to see tonight. It's called Cursed Plants, and I've taken the hobby on this very interesting subject
to a talk that glorifies our Creator, gives you a different look at the creation.
So as you think about this, we're going to take a step back to something. These are becoming very rare, but they're called hymns, right? The old hymn books. When you look in the hymn books, you'll see hymns like this. And this was one that I thought was quite interesting. "This is my Father's world." It's the title of this hymn. "The birds their carols raise. The morning light, the lily white, declare their maker's praise." Isn't that beautiful? It's talking about little birds, okay? Their songs. And the lilies, the flowers, declaring their maker's praise. "Each little flower that opens, each little bird that sings, he made their glowing colors, he made their tiny wings." Isn't that beautiful? And as I took a look through some of the plants that I grow, there's one plant that puts forth little yellow flowers. Isn't that gorgeous? But here's the problem. If you follow this flower stalk back to the plant that produced it, it ate the bird. This is real. This is a plant that's actually consumed the bird. And I thought to myself as I looked at this, our hymn books are a little schizophrenic. Because if you read your average hymn book, it presents the world in these beautiful glowing colors. And there is things like this out there that you have to have an explanation for if you are a believer. Because this flower is beautiful, but it eats birds. Now, the birds are not its primary diet, but it can happen. In fact, there are plants that not only eat insects, they can consume an occasional bird, rodents, lizards, okay, spiders, things that are not insects. So today we're going to take a look into this bizarre world of carnivorous plants. First question, what is a carnivorous plant? Very simply put, it's a plant that eats meat. Now, when they first began discovering these plants, which was back in the 1700s, they called them insectivorous because they assumed they only consumed insects. We've since now, like I explained, we now know there are plants that can consume animals, so the proper term is a carnivorous plant. When we're looking for a carnivorous plant, there are four things we look for. It's a plant that has the ability to attract prey. Now, normally, you don't think of plants in terms of attracting prey. When you think of plants, you normally smell those nice things they grow to attract insects, flowers, and they're attracting pollinators. Well, carnivorous plants do produce flowers, but they also have another way of attracting prey. They'll have a mechanism for capturing the prey that they have attracted or lured to it. You'll discover tonight that there is more than one way that the plants have, quote, figured out how to do this. They'll have the ability to break down or digest the prey that they have captured. And again, that's done in more than one way for the express purpose of receiving nutrition from the prey that has been attracted, captured, and broken down, and the plant uses that nutrition. That leads me to a question. Why do we even have carnivorous plants? Because you have corn, and you've got tomatoes, and you've got things like that, and they're not generally considered carnivorous. So why on earth do you even have a carnivorous plant? Well, that has to do a lot with where these plants grow. And this area happens to be right where you folks live, down into Muskegon, a prime place for them. In fact, Muskegon is long muskeg. Is the word muskeg is the Indian word for bog or wetland. And you'll find them in there. This is a wetland in southwest Michigan down in Buchanan. And interestingly enough about this, bogs are pretty much were all formed by the Ice Age. And we believe that Noah's flood precipitated or caused a brief ice age. It was not hundreds of millions of years long. What we believe is that as the flood was proceeding and beginning to wane, it caused changes to the earth that caused an ice age that lasted about 500 to 700 years. These ice sheets formed from the north and went down as far as central Ohio. And then as the earth began to come back into equilibrium, these sheets began to retreat backward up into Canada. And every so often, big pieces of glacier would break off, and they would excavate out these ponds in the ground. This beautiful, pristine water would melt into it, and they would form what we call glacial ponds. And a moss called sphagnum moss would get into this water, and it covers the surface like a, how many of you remember the 1970s, shag carpet? It literally covers the surface of the water like a shag carpet from the outside in. So eventually, an entire lake can cover over with this moss. And other plants like leather leaf and rushes will get into that, and it gives it a little stability. But if you've ever walked out on the surface of a bog with moss and you jump up and down, the whole thing undulates like you're on a waterbed. And what forms underneath that is a peat deposit. The moss is alive at the top. It grows upward. The bottom decays and forms this brown dirt-like substance. And interestingly, if you're not careful on a bog, if you walk to the wrong area, you can puncture that surface and disappear into this stuff. And I was stuck once for 45 minutes to get myself out of it. It's not a place you should ever go alone just for that specific reason. But when you think about that, if you see this area here, there's no trees in the middle of it. They can't grow there. So lots of sun gets to this area. Carnivorous plants, by and large, are very sun-loving plants. So this area where they grow, there's thousands of them buried in this, love lots of sun. And, of course, because of the moisture underneath it, it's very wet. And then, even more interesting, the sphagnum moss acts like a water softener, but it's a little bit different. If you have a water softener in your home, those resin beads inside that cylinder are treated with sodium. And as your water passes through that, those beads attract the magnesium and calcium out of your water, and they give off a little sodium. So your water goes from being hard to soft. All those minerals disappear. Sphagnum moss will soak up all of the nutrients in the water, things like magnesium, calcium, and nitrogen that plants like corn and tomatoes need to grow. So the area becomes very low in nutrients, and then that moss gives off acid, so the area becomes low in nutrients, highly acidic. Corn, potatoes, and celery would not grow in this soil. The carnivorous plants make up for the nutrients missing in the soil by obtaining it from the bodies of the animals they kill and digest. That's why they do that, and that's where they grow. In fact, here's what's below the surface of a peat bog. And this is where you find this moss you put in your gardens. By the way, in Europe, you know, they find what are called bog mummies. This is really bizarre stuff. Some of these people were actually murdered ritualistically, we think, by these ancient cultures that were right after the flood. And they were sacrificed and thrown in these bogs. And even now, if you unearth them, you can still see what they look like. Their skin becomes tanned like in a tannery. The bones disappear, but you can make out their facial features. Sometimes the clothes are still intact, and they're 500 to over 1,000 years old, and they're called bog mummies. Very mysterious kind of a place. So as you think of this creepy place, we're going to look at a couple of ways that plants that live there can lure, capture, and digest insects or animals for food. And the first one we're going to look at are what we call sticky fly papers. And specifically, these are the sundews. Now, sundews grow on every continent except the Antarctic, and you've got them right here in Oceania County. And just to give you an idea of how they operate, you'll see the green leaf, and that leaf is covered with lots of little modified hair structures, and each of those hairs is tipped with a little drop of a sugar secretion. And you'll see from my finger there, if I touch that and pull back, it gives a little bit of a taffy effect. Now, for you and I, that's nothing. It's like touching syrup. But if you're a small insect and you land on that, that's like falling in Elmer's glue. Now, these plants grow in wide ranges of areas. You can find them in desert regions of Australia where they go dormant during the dry season and come back in the rainy season. You find them in the mountains of Africa. You find them here in Michigan. So they can grow in a wide variety of environments, and they come in a whole different group of shapes and sizes. Some sundews, the whole plant would fit on a dime. Other sundews, the plant might be 3 or 4 feet across. Some sundews, the leaves move, and some sundews, the leaves don't. This particular species, you'll find this being sold at Lowe's or Home Depot a lot of times in the spring. It's from South Africa. It's called the Cape sundew. And the leaves are only about 6 inches long, and about 2 inches of the leaf is like the toothbrush with these hairs covered with this sticky substance. So this particular insect right here was in my den a few years ago, pestering me in the spring, and it must have hatched in a windowsill box. It was in March, and I had a whole group of these plants on the windowsill, and it was buzzing around over there, and I heard the buzzing stop. So I knew what had happened, so I grabbed my camera, and I walked over, and sure enough, there's this fly stuck on the end of this leaf, and you'll notice at the bottom of the picture, some of those tentacles are bent, and you can see that one long strand coming off the fly's leg. Now, if the insect is not strong enough to break free, here's what happened. It gets on there and it starts struggling against those tentacles. And on this particular sundew, it moves. And it doesn't have to move very fast. This takes several hours. But what will happen is those tentacles begin to slowly arc inward toward their prey. And every time one of those tentacles bends and touches the insect's body, it deposits another drop of this sugar substance, which also has a digestive enzyme in it. And it'll completely coat their body. And they breathe through holes in their sides. They don't breathe through a nose. And once they're totally covered, they suffocate. So here's a brief clip here, just showing you kind of in sped up motion how this might work. The more the fly struggles, the more rapidly the leaf responds. This process might take 6 to 7 hours to fully complete itself. And you'll notice every time a droplet makes contact, it kind of disappears and forms this covering. Not a very pleasant way to go. Now, get this. Over the period of about 24 hours, it looks like this. Now, I want you to imagine what's happened. The body of this insect has been totally coated in a digestive goo. That leaf is squeezing extremely tightly. It would actually take a little force for you to pull it open. And what's happened is that goo has penetrated the exoskeleton of the insect. It gets inside its body, turns the inside into a liquid, and then the leaf acts like your hand squeezing a sponge. And it's absorbing all of the nutrients that were inside that insect, nitrogen, calcium, magnesium, that's missing in the soil, and it absorbs it into the leaf. And then what will happen after it sets that way for about 7 to 10 days, and we don't fully understand the process, that leaf will slowly uncurl and reset itself, and here's what our fly looks like. And if it kind of looks like a crushed can, because all that's left is the exoskeleton, which was folded over, and everything inside was burst out and sucked into the leaf. Now, these leaves can do this 3-4 times before that particular leaf wears out. That leaf will turn brown and die after about 3 insects. Other leaves are replacing it. Now, that might act as advertising for the next insect. There are spiders that will come running onto the leaf thinking that that's a live fly. It will get trapped. Or other flies that aren't very picky eaters will land on this, and the same process takes place. It's an incredibly complex and ingenious design. Now, what I'm about to tell you next is what I call coffee table chatter. And you folks are here tonight, and I assume that you're the diehards. So I'm going to give you a little bit of information that is fun to talk about with your friends when discussing creation evolution. It's a little known fact about Charles Darwin that most people have never figured out. The Creation Museum did a 3-part series on Darwin, and they missed this. I couldn't believe it. So I had to have words with Tommy Mitchell. How could you miss this? So if you have glasses, it works really, really cool, right? You go and you have yourself a night where your friends are over and you say, hey, let's discuss creation evolution. Can you tell me what Charles Darwin's favorite subject was? You take your glasses off and you weren't eating. Wait for the answers to come back. Now, you might get he loved beetles. We know this. There's a story about where he had 2 handfuls of beetles and he found another beetle that was really cool. And what he did is he grabbed the other beetle. He couldn't get in his hand, so he held them in his mouth. Now, he was really interested in this beetle. He did research on barnacles. There's this island down there off of South America. What's those island chains called? The Galapagos, right? There was these birds on there, right? The finches. Did a lot of work on the Galapagos finches. Well, after everybody gives you the wrong answers, he told us in a letter to an American botanist what his favorite subject was. Here it is. This was written to an American botanist named Asa Gray. He said, I care more about Drosera, that's the nerdy scientific name for sundews, than I do the origin of all the species in the world. This is what most people don't know. He wrote a book in 1859 called On the Origin of Species. That's when it was released. That's the book that made him famous. In 1871, he released another book called The Insectivorous Plants. And most people don't know about this book. This was his favorite subject. He told that American botanist it was his favorite subject, was carnivorous plants. Specifically, the round-leaf sundew, which grows right here in Michigan, was his absolute favorite subject to study. Now, this particular book, unlike On the Origin of Species, where he shared his ideas on how one type of animal could change into another over time. This book didn't really get into that. This was good observational science where he studied the leaves of these different plants to document that they were truly carnivorous. Now think about this. In his day, before his theory really became popular, the creation worldview was the dominant worldview. Creationists at that time were emphatically teaching God created all plants to be food. And in fact, Linnaeus, Carolus Linnaeus, he's the fellow that developed binomial nomenclature, those long names in Latin that we use today. Linnaeus did not believe these plants were carnivorous at first. He said that was against God's created order. Darwin went out of his way to document that that was not the case. I think what might have driven him a little bit was to prove the creationists wrong, and in fact, these plants were quite interesting. These pictures of the sundew leaf you see right here were drawn by his sons. He had Francis and George drew all the illustrations for this book, and you can see they're absolutely beautiful illustrations. So again, if you want to answer your friends, his favorite subject was sundews, and he was absolutely enthralled by carnivorous plants. So that's one way that a plant can lure through a nice shiny substance that has a sugar in it, capture through sticky and then tentacles and digest animals. Now, he also covers in this book another carnivorous plant. Does everybody recognize this one? What do we call this plant? The Venus flytrap, probably the most famous one. One of the things I discovered in my studies when I was 10 years old in the National Geographic, I assumed that this plant grew in Africa. Actually only grows one place naturally in the entire world, and that's in the area of the Cape Fear River mouth by North and South Carolina, where they meet on the East Coast, a very small geographic location. It's the only place they grow naturally in the entire world. So it's an American plant. It's not tropical. You know, when I was 5 years old trying to grow those kits, I tried to find the darkest, hottest place of my bedroom to grow them, like Africa, you know, in the jungle. So I would stick them by the radiator. So I probably just steamed them to death. Well, they actually don't grow that way. And I have to admit, I'm at least this much of a Darwinist because I agree with this statement that Darwin made about this particular plant. He said, this plant, commonly called Venus flytrap, from the rapidity and force of its movements, is one of the most wonderful in the world. You know, Charles, I can agree with him on that. Now, if you've never worked with one of these plants, tonight is going to be a treat for you because when you see how they operate, I guarantee a few of you are going to go out and buy some this spring. But let's take a look at the plant. Doesn't get very large. The whole plant might be several inches across, maybe 8 inches, 4-inch leaves. Does not get very big. But if you're into science fiction, that's your plant because it looks nasty. And it actually looks somewhat like a bear trap. So we classify this as a snap trap. Unlike the sundew, which is a flypaper-like plant, this plant actually snaps shut. But unlike a bear trap, it has more in common with a mouse trap. So when you think of a mouse trap in the set position, there is stored energy in the spring, and that's what allows for the rapid closure. You have to pull that thing back and cock it. All the energy is what allows for it to snap so quickly. Now also, there's going to be bait strategically located to attract prey. Now, on mouse traps, what are the bait we usually use on mouse traps? Peanut butter and cheese, right? Which one's better? Why is peanut? Look at these guys, they're so smart. Why peanut butter? It sticks, right? It makes the mouse stay there longer because you can run across and grab a piece of cheese, but if it starts nibbling on that peanut butter, well, there's a trigger mechanism right where you put that peanut butter that will snap that mouse trap in one touch. Now, let's take a look at our Venus flytrap. In the set position, you'll notice one thing. The plant is arced outward. See this here? The leaf is what we call convex. Now, if this little fellow right here, what's his name? Was that Joel, if you were a bug, this would be about the right ratio right here. That plant would look about that big, and you'd be about your size, and you'd see this thing arced outward. And the reason is the energy for the rapid closure is in the tips of the leaf. Unlike a mouse trap, which snaps shut all at once, or a bear trap that snaps shut all at once, the Venus flytrap closes in a series of stages designed to conserve energy. It's absolutely amazing. Now, the other thing that it all has, it also has bait. And if you look at a Venus flytrap in the set position, the bait is right along the edge, like right here. And there's a sweet sugar secretion all along the inside edge. And the idea is it likes, like a little guy like Joel, it'd be like having ice cream smeared all over that thing. And it wants the prey to go inside and start feeding up that trail, because the Venus flytrap also has trigger mechanisms. And it has six of them total. You'll see the arrow pointing at one. There are six trigger mechanisms all the way around that thing, three on each side. This thing is giving me fits here. Hang on a second. There we go. And it's like this. If you touch one of those trigger mechanisms, okay, so you feed up there and you bend it far enough, the cells at the base, as that thing bends, will get squeezed, and those cells send out an electrical message very similar to flipping a light switch. And that message goes through the whole leaf, but nothing happens. But a timer starts, and the plant is on alert for about 30 seconds. And if the insect stays there and keeps feeding and touches the same trigger hair that it just touched or any of the other five in that 30-second time span, a second electrical message goes out through the leaf, and the upper third folds over like this in half a second. Now, quick question. Why is two touches better for the Venus flytrap than a one touch on a mouse trap? Here's why. If your mouse trap accidentally gets sprung, who's got to reset that? You do, and it takes energy to reset it. Now, if the flytrap were to close on one touch, it would use up energy and then have to reset itself. And the plant, I'm talking like it's thinking, but the plant's not thinking. It's built this way. By requiring two touches, it raises the stakes that there's something inside moving around. And it didn't just close on a twig blowing through there on a windy day. So it's designed to close on two touches. Now, how many of you have never seen a Venus flytrap close in actual time? Get the hands up good and high. Oh, I love this. You ready? Here we go. I'm going to take an insect, and I'm going to stick it into this Venus flytrap, and here's actual speed. Half a second. Think about that. The plant responded to the stimuli. How many trigger hairs had to be touched? Two. See that again? All right, here's one more time. That's a horsefly. I hate those things. And now the plant, the upper third has locked over, and it's holding the prey. Now, not everything that goes in stays in. Here's an ant. Now, normally, those bristles act like prison bars to hold the prey inside. But before they get a chance to completely lock, out he goes. You imagine the story he told when he got back to the hill? You won't believe what just happened to me. Right? Right. We have plants that eat insects. Sure, they exist. Okay, we believe you. Now, here's where this gets really interesting. If the plant is triggered shut, you can trigger a Venus flytrap shut with your finger or a tweezer. Anything that touches two trigger hairs will cause that thing to fold over. But if there's nothing inside that it can consume, you could put a BB in there. It'll close on the BB. It can sense whether it can eat it or not. If it's something that's tricked it shut that it cannot eat, it doesn't use any more energy than what you just saw. Over the next 24 hours, it's resetting itself. So by the next day, it's fully set. But immediately, it knows whether it can consume what's been put in there. Now, this gets even more tricky. How does the fly trap know there's something in there that it can eat? There's two ways that we think. The first way is that those trigger hairs, if the insect is running back and forth hitting those trigger hairs, that's sending out more messages that tells the leaf to keep closing. The second way, what do you think that insect does? It's in there, it's feeding on that nectar, all of a sudden, wham, it's trapped. What do you think the insect does the moment that happens to it? What's that? It doesn't make noise. You're getting closer. It's kind of an embarrassing thing, and it's for science, but what do you think you might do if you were suddenly scared, right? Right. There you go. It poops its pants, or in scientific terms, it's You ready? It excretes, okay? And we believe that the cells on the inside of the fly trap's trap can sense the urea in the excretion. And that tells it that there is an insect in here that it can eat. So rather than opening up again, it will now continue to close over the next 30 minutes or so. So here's what the process looks like after it now knows it can eat something. So you'll notice the sides come in. Imagine if I close my hands just like this. This is how it works. The upper third just bends over. They interlock. Now, if I bring my palms together, my fingers will naturally begin to stand up just a little bit. And that's exactly what starts happening to the insect. The walls of the plant begin to come inward. They begin to secrete digestive enzymes onto the insect. And as this happens, those bristles will begin to stand upright. And during this entire process, which could take, it depends on the day. If it's a hot day, it can take place in 20 minutes. A little bit cooler day might take a full hour. Now it's like having your hands pressed together like this. Bristles are straight up. You'd have a little pocket in your palm. And there's a seal that actually forms along the inside of your knuckles or on the inside of the trap. It actually produces a gasketing material that seals this off so none of the digestive processes can leak out. It's almost like a Ziploc storage bag. And inside of this, a bug soup is created. The digestive enzymes penetrate the insect's body, very much like on the sundew, turns the inside of the body into a broth, and then the leaf squeezes that out, and the leaf absorbs that, and that's where the plant gets the nitrogen, calcium, and magnesium, things like that missing from the soil. But when you think about it, miracle of miracles, you've gone from a plant that was a trap to a stomach. It has quite literally turned into a plant stomach, digesting the insect and absorbing the nutrients. And it'll stay like this for, again, about 7 to 10 days, very similar to the sundew. And at the end of that 7 to 10 day period, we don't know how the leaf knows this, but once the nutrients are absorbed, it will open again. And here's what our fly looks like. Notice anything peculiar about the eyes on this critter? If you were to take the fly, you can, and you break it open, it's hollow all the way inside. All that's left is the outside. So the eyes are basically hollow inside. Everything's been sucked out of it. Sometimes the rain will wash that out, and other times it's glued there, and that will act as advertising for another insect. So here's a case where we had a box elder bug that was probably meal number one. A week later, the plant opened up again, and a nosy fly went in there. That was meal number two. An individual leaf on a Venus fly trap can consume up to 3 insects, and then that leaf dies. That's perfectly normal. I know a lot of people grow these things. My plant turned black. They throw it in the garbage. The leaves will only consume maximum 3 insects, and they wear out. Other leaves will replace it. In fact, here's an example. Got 2 healthy leaves. That leaf in the middle, that's black, has consumed its couple of 2 to 3 insects, and it now just turns black. I just snip those off. How many of you have ever owned a Venus fly trap? I have to ask this question. Has this come over you whenever the fly trap was around? When I do my big talks at the Creation Museum, I have to guard my fly traps because there's some sort of a phenomenon with human beings that if I turn my back for a minute, people just come walking over like this. They want to put their finger in there. In fact, my last talk of the day, I usually do talks on Friday and Saturday. On the last talk I do on Saturday, I invite all the kids up because you know what they want to do. Because I don't want them closed during the other talks. And they just love sticking their fingers in there because it'll close on anything that disturbs it. However, you can do that once in a while to amaze your friends. But here's the problem. If you did that every day on every trap on your plant, because you can do that and it'll open up the following day, the plant will run out of energy. And it can consume 3 insects per trap, but that mechanism only works about 7 times per trap. So if you never fed it and you did that on Monday, it'll be open Tuesday. You did it on Tuesday, it'll open Wednesday. By Sunday, that trap is no longer functional. I see some heads down. If you did that, it's okay. You didn't know what you were doing. Okay, but so you can do it once in a while. Just don't make it a habit. Now, I get this question a lot because it's such a cool plant. How big do they get? This is the largest you will ever see a Venus flytrap. They do not get much bigger than this. So if you see some ads on eBay for giant flytraps, don't believe it. This is as large as they can get. However, if we have any young people in here that want to become a mad scientist and see if they can break this genetic code and make giant fly traps. This is not a joke. You will be a millionaire. I kid you not. If you could produce a fly trap where the trap was the size of a hand, it would be worth millions to the nursery trade because people want bigger fly traps. So here's, you want to get your son involved in something? The science of giant fly traps. And it's okay to be a millionaire if you tithe, right, Pastor? Right? Get a plant like this and you'd really make it rich. We love that in New Jersey, getting rid of those neighbors with the loud dog. God made the Venus flytrap. It does not get any bigger than what we can see. They have been trying for the last 60 years. Chemicals, radiation, special breeding to grow gigantic flytraps because the money is enormous in big flytraps. Even that one I just showed you, the size of a quarter, I could sell a plant like that for $50. And it's really nothing special. It's just an average, you know, good-sized flytrap. So we've seen a sticky flypaper, grows all over the world except the Antarctic. We just saw the Venus flytrap, snap trap, grows in the Carolinas. This last one I'm going to show you is a very simple type of trap. We call it a pitfall trap, just like the idea of digging a hole and letting things fall into it. Now, these are the real gluttons, if you want to call a plant a glutton of the carnivorous plant world. They can consume lots and lots of insects. In fact, here's the species that grows right here in Michigan. You'll find this around this area. This is called the purple pitcher plant. I've got them growing in some terrariums at home. And only gets about 5 to 6 inches tall, and it captures rainwater. And insects will fall into this plant through a series of mechanisms and drown in the rainwater and be digested. But the one I'm going to focus on today is a cousin of this plant. And I say cousin because it's definitely related to it. They're from the same created kind, but they're a little bit different in the way it's been adapted. These are called trumpet pitcher plants. And these grow in the southeast coastal plain, like from Maryland on down to the Florida panhandle over into Texas. And these plants can grow about 3 foot tall, and they look like one of those trumpets you might see the Romans showing at gladiator games. Basically a long hollow tube with a little bit of a lid over it, and there's no movement whatsoever. But they are designed magnificently for catching large quantities of insects. Here's the lid over the top of the one opening, and you'll see this fly up there. And what has caused the fly to land there are nectar glands. So insect comes along, smells the aroma, sees this color. Here's a close-up of the nectar glands. Little tiny drops of sugar all over the top of this plant. So the insect flying by will want to land to feed. Now also, insects that crawl up the plant we'll discover that there are nectar glands all the way up the front of this pitcher. And where do you think the area of richest nectar is going to be? Right over that opening. This plant's tricky. Whether you fly in or walk in, the plant's leading you to that opening to get you over that area, and you'll see how shiny it is right there. Well, that area, you can see it better next picture. The nectar is laced with a narcotic. Actually can drug the insect. And depending on the species we're looking at, the narcotic can be stronger or weaker. Then you also have these, you can see it better on this species. See those little hairs? Now, to us, they're nothing. But remember, if you're an insect, that's like having daggers that long. And the whole leaf is covered with them in that area. So the insect will be walking on that. It's feeding on this nectar that's lined with a narcotic. And it's got these hairs pushing on its feet. And if you were to blow up the wall of the pitcher plant with a microscope, the cells that line the inside there look like little shark's teeth all facing down. So it's slippery, covered with a nectar that's got a narcotic in it. There's hairs pointing down. And an insect's foot pad looks like this. And as it grips on those cells that are triangular shaped, they can't get a grip. They're constantly slipping. So here's a fly that I'm going to grab with a pair of tweezers, and I'm going to put it up to this nectar on a plant and let go. Now, normally, if you catch a fly with your fingers and put it next to anything, what's the fly going to do the second you let go? Watch how quickly this fly gets just totally taken over by the nectar. So here you go. 1 second, 2 second, 3 second, let go. Right into the plant, you'll see it feeding at the back, and its feet are slipping the entire time. Less than 5 seconds, it's gone. Down it goes. And this particular species is from Texas. Whenever I have guests at the house that want to come into the greenhouse and watch these plants, I take them to this plant because this one is lethal. Sometimes you can see 2, 3, 4 insects at a time on this plant falling in, and sometimes the entire tube, which can be up to 2 foot tall, will fill up in a couple of days with hundreds of insects. So you got the insect to slip and fall in. Why can't it fly out? This is an extended footage of a hornet that's down inside a pitcher tube. Now remember, where these plants grow, they have to have a lot of sunlight. So the tubes get very, very hot. So inside there, the insect is struggling like crazy to get out. Can't get a grip on those walls that are downward lapped, roof shingle-like with sharks-type teeth cells on it. And every so often, you'll notice its wings start to flap, but it doesn't gain any altitude. Now, this can go on for several hours, and eventually, the insect will exhaust itself, die, or get and just slip to the bottom, and there's digestive enzymes at the bottom that take care of the insect. It's a good thing we don't understand what it's saying right here, because it's probably not happy. All right, why couldn't it fly out? Here's just an example. Look at this one, piled up with insects. Here's what happens inside a pitcher tube. The moment that insect tries to fly up, it has to beat its wings to send the jet of air down. What happens is the air goes down, but that automatically will draw air in from the top. What goes down? More has to come in. So what will happen is the insect will get just a little bit of lift, but basically it just sucks itself right back. The harder it tries to fly out, the more of its own energy it uses against itself. Talk about a diabolical setup to make you to get in there, get drugged, fall in, and then basically kill yourself trying to get out. And then it's going to eat you when you can't make it. Remember that hornet we just looked at? You can have a little fun with them when they're inside the pitcher tubes. We need our sound. Sound. We go back. Try it again. That's done on one of these plants. So the question I have to ask before I show you this, I'm going to take one of these plants, I'm going to slice it open and show you what's inside of it at the end. But it's gross. So you in for seeing this? All right. So here's what you would find in the, quote, stomach of a gigantic pitcher plant. All right, let's hit it up. There will literally be the digested bodies of hundreds of insects that have just been caught. These plants will fill up maybe 2 to 3 foot high, break their tissues down, absorb it into the leaf, and then the leaf eventually just rots and falls over dead. But it did the job. It's looking for the nutrients missing in the soil. It gets absorbed in the leaf, goes down in the root system, and that's where it is stored to make little pitcher plants for the following year. So you've seen three ways that you can do an insect can be captured by a plant. Different ways, sticky fly papers, snap traps, pitfall plants. We're going to leave the United States now and go to Southeast Asia and look at what are called the Nepenthes pitcher plants. Now, these are really beautiful plants, and a lot of garden centers are selling them now. They work similarly to the American pitcher plant, but instead of growing out of the ground as a tube, they grow on vines hanging down. They may root themselves in the side of a tree or in the side of a cliff, and they'll hang down. And what's interesting, you see this on the screen right here, some of these pitchers can be about that big. On some species, they're the size of a thimble, but some can become the size of a basketball. This particular one right here is called Raja. That pitcher is the size of a basketball. You could pour a 2-liter inside of it. Very similar idea. The lip around the rim there is coated with a nectar. Some of them have a narcotic on it. The plant pumps a fluid inside of it. Insects will come to that to feed, get drugged, slip and fall inside, as you saw with a bird. If the bird reaches in to get an insect and falls in and it cannot get out, it will digest the bird. Lizards will fall in there at times, and so will things like rats. Plant completely capable of doing that. This is a species that I grow at my home. It's a very sought-after species. It's called Nepenthes hamata. You see that rim is lined with what looks like hooks, and there's a drop of nectar on it, primarily designed to catch insects that will crawl to the end of that hook, feed on the nectar, slip and fall inside, and be digested. However, if a mouse sticks its head into that, it will not be able to pull its head back. It'll be forced to go inside. The plant can digest mice. Absolutely a diabolical plant. By the way, just to give you an idea, these plants, I have 4-inch cuttings right now that are valued at over $500 a piece because that's how rare the plant is. So people are really seeking after these. So again, if you don't want to make the big fly trap, grow Nepenthes hamata if you can get it to go in your house. Now you think about what you've just seen. This is my father's world. There's 700 species of plant that eat bugs and insects and animals. All right, we got to answer that. So from a biblical perspective, how do we answer the question of carnivorous plants? First thing I think of, when you look at the Venus flytrap, everything about that plant absolutely screams design. Think about it. Double touch mechanism to save energy closing on twigs. It actually has a mechanism helping it to capture moving objects. The plant closes in a series of stages to save energy. The plant has a setup where the nectar leads the insect to the trigger mechanisms. And this is where things really get crazy. Mousetrap. No evolutionist in his right mind would ever claim that a mousetrap could be formed by a series of accidents in a wood factory. Right? The mousetrap shows design. Which is more complex? The mousetrap you buy at Menards or the Venus flytrap? The Venus flytrap is on the orders of billions of times more complex. And just two examples would be this. If I rip a leaf off a Venus flytrap, it will self-diagnose itself that it needs a new trap and it will grow a new one to replace it. If I break a mouse trap, guess who replaces it? Me. Not to mention that a couple of times in the flytrap's life, it makes seeds to reproduce itself. It makes little flytraps. I'd love to see anybody take a mouse trap and make it so that it's self-reproducing. You never have to go to the store to buy a new one because when it wears out, it makes new mouse traps. The fly trap is on the orders of times, billions of times more complex. It's just their thought processes are all corked up with this evolutionary thinking. On top of that, biblically speaking, we know the plants were created on day what? 3. And the Bible tells us plants were created to be food for everything. Remember what I said before about the Bible not being a science textbook. There's another thing that plants perform for us that is not mentioned in the Bible that is absolutely vital to all life on earth. Does anybody know what that is? Photosynthesis, right? In order to make oxygen. So they are also food. They also help us with oxygen. They do not have a life spirit. They are not considered living in the same way animals are. But at the initial creation, when God created everything, plants were there to be consumed. And God called everything at the end of that 6th day very good. In Hebrew, it's a real cool mi'od tov. And it means good exceedingly to the highest. It's like saying perfect in English. Maybe this is what, see if we can get the sound going here. Maybe if we could, and by the way, just in case we can't. All right, let's try it again. This is what things would have looked like at the creation week before Adam sinned. Well, we get along. Yeah, we really do. And there's nothing wrong. Who are we? Oh,
best threatening place. Take the scary out of life with Travelers Insurance and see the world in a different light.
I do not know Travelers Insurance from Adam, but I thought this commercial was very appropriate because you realize that it's very possible that that's what the initial creation looked like before sin, that these animals would not have been carnivorous that way. So what happened? What went wrong? You have to go to Genesis chapter 3. And unto Adam he said, God talking back to Adam and Eve, after they had disobeyed him, God had given them that command to stay away from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Adam had been pre-warned. They knew this. That, and God said, in the day that you eat of that, you shall surely die. And in Hebrew, it's an interesting phrase. It's not on the day, so when you bite the apple, you will die, or whatever fruit it was. It's in the day, and it's actually in dying you shall die. It actually reads in Hebrew that the process of death would begin. And after that, God speaks to them and says this, and this is in verse 17, cursed is the ground for thy sake. There is a series of pronouncements God puts on the creation because of what Adam did, because of his disobedience, and two of them refer to the cursing of the ground. And in verse 18, plants specifically, thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. And Adam, up until this point, did not have to worry about thorns and thistles. You know, when I see a plant that looks like this, you know what those are around that edge? Those are thorn-like structures. And we can assume that many of the plants we see today, like rose bushes and things like that, did not have those structures on them as they do now. They were inserted into creation. Either God had pre-programmed it into their DNA, knowing that the fall would come, or he inserted it later. But either way, there were changes to the creation, changes to animal life, and specifically today for the plant life, that made them covered with thorns, thistles, and not as pleasant. Does anybody recognize this? Poison ivy. You know, when Adam and Eve walked through the Garden of Eden, they walked through the Garden of Eden buck naked. They didn't have to worry about this. See, not only would you have thorns and thistles, we have toxicity in plants coming out now. We've got, in fact, there are mushrooms, Amanita phalloides, which is it's called the death cap. Put that in your salad. You know what happens to you? If you eat it for dinner, you don't have to worry about a midnight snack. It puts you out, like it kills your liver. You'll die from it. Their creation was clearly changed because of Adam's sin, and we would assume many of these plants took on these qualities that we see today, as fascinating as they are, as a result of Adam's sin. Now, getting back to our hymn books, there was one hymn in a hymn book of over 500 songs that seemed to have caught this right, where all the other ones talked about the world as though everything was perfect. See if you recognize this particular hymn, and I can guarantee you, you probably sing it once per year. It says, no more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow, far as the curse is found. Does anybody recognize the song? Yeah. Joy to the world. The Christmas song. The theology of the Christmas song is correct, that there are thorns infesting the ground now. Why? Far as the curse is found. Christ came to make his blessings flow, far as the curse is found. We live in a cursed world. Now, if we stop the story there, it's not much fun. But you know what's even more interesting? It has to take you back. Anything we use, carnivorous plants, I don't care what you talk about, it's got to go back to the gospel. The world is definitely cursed today. And God demonstrated his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ, the Creator, the lawgiver, stepped into creation, took on flesh, lived the perfect life, taught us how we should live and act, and then offered himself as a sacrifice so that if we put our faith in him, we can have eternal life. And here's the neat part. This particular passage in Acts chapter 3 I find really cool. Peter is saying this, and Luke records it. Talking about Jesus, he says, heaven must receive until the times of restoration of all things. And when you think of something that needs to be restored, you're thinking about something that looked nice once, it's now in a bad condition, and it's going to be fixed. And it says here that Jesus has been taken back to heaven until the time when things will be fixed. And how will things be fixed? Revelation chapter 22, verse 3. And there shall be no more curse. Now, if I was selling plants right now, I would shamelessly use that as a tactic to say, well, if you want to grow up these carnivorous plants, you better buy them now because we don't know what they're going to do in the future. So we can come up and buy one now. But this is just an example here that the curse someday is going to be removed. You see these things? I'm throwing these away someday. And it's because I've put my faith in Jesus Christ. I don't have to worry about things of the future. My future is taken care of. But even through these crazy plants, you can see the gospel message being shown to us to take you back. Someday it's all going to be done away with. Now, we have a few moments for questions. So if you have any questions on what you just saw, I'll take a few minutes to answer your questions. Nobody wants to stay later. I'll tell you what I will do for you. I'll be up here for a few minutes. So afterwards, come on up and you can ask some questions about what you saw. By the way, is anybody even slightly interested in growing a fly trap now? Go on the Answers in Genesis website and type in how to grow a Venus flytrap. I've got an article there. It teaches you the secrets on how to grow one of these plants, even how to pick out a good one at the store. So I'll close this in a quick word of prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank you again for your marvelous word. Lord, we thank you for the creation. One thing we have to realize, Lord, is even though the creation is beautiful, it's cursed. We see things in it that don't make sense. And when we have to look back in the Bible, we look back and we see, well, why some of these things are out of place, why we have plants that make us sick, animals that can injure us, Lord. It was not your intent that things would be that way. But through the sin of Adam, which we all repeat, Lord, the curse is on this creation. We thank you that Christ came to make his blessings flow as far as the curse is found. I pray that everyone here tonight, Lord, would have put their faith in you so that someday they could take part in the restoration of all things when the curse is removed. And we give you the praise and ask for again for safe travels for those heading home. In Jesus' name, amen. You are dismissed.